Okay, as we talked about last time, we're in the second half of the Exodus, the part that nobody made a movie about. We're in the plannings for the Mishkan, and we've actually finished most of the plannings, and now it's time to decide who is going to be in charge of it. We also, in this week's Parsha, deal with the golden calf, which is obviously more popular and talked about. But I wanted to focus in on one guy. He doesn't get a lot of coverage in the Bible, but there is an institute in Israel named after him. Bezalel is the guy who's in charge. He's the head architect, head builder, head everything. He's in charge of the whole undertaking. Now there's an art institute in Israel named after him. So I want to dive in and figure out who the rabbis say he is. This is the best picture I could come up with. It's a palette on the front. All the rest were ridiculous. So on the first two pages, I have every time he's mentioned in the Bible, which is not often. It's once in our Parsha, once again in Vayakhel. This is the Parsha where God says, you, Moses, go tell Bezalel he's in charge. And the next one, Vayakhel, is the one where Moses goes, tells Bezalel, you're in charge now. And then there's one other time in the book of Chronicles where his lineage is linked to Caleb. Oh. So Caleb and Joshua are the two spies who the first time around say, yeah, we should go take it. We can do it. God's on our side. Caleb's one of the people who gets to go into the land of Israel, even though he was also from Egypt. He's also, it doesn't say it here, but midrashically, he's considered to be Miriam's husband, which makes Bezalel Miriam's grandson or great-grandson. I can't count. But of great lineage, let's say. So that's the general. Now I want to read it in the text itself, and I want to see our job today is what was so great about Bezalel? Who is this guy? Why was he worthy of being the guy in charge of literally making God's house? Okay. Someone up for reading? We're on page 2 now. English is fine. We'll reference Hebrew if we need to along the way. There's a couple of words we'll need to, but I'll take care of that part. Great.
And the Lord said unto Moses, saying, see, I've called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah.
Okay, let's pause. Just start there. Is there anything interesting so far? Anything that jumps out at anyone? Questions? Anything?
Judah again.
Okay, so definitely tribe of Judah. We should always pay attention about whenever the tribe of Judah comes up, because we know Judah eventually is us. We like the people who make it, so there's probably something going on there. Excellent. Yes. Yes. Right.
I call him by name.
Yes.
And so, you know, that just always struck me.
Yes, it's weird. Like Moses and God are talking up on Mount Sinai, and God says, look, first of all, they're in the top of the mountain. What's he looking at? Like, it's like an odd, it's an odd thing to do. And I have called him by name. That's actually a pretty good translation. I have called him by name, yes. But when? I single, it's not command form, but it is I singled this guy out, yes.
It has a strength.
Yeah, it's a strong, absolutely a strong word, I agree.
I have called.
Okay, so stronger than I have called. But still, in the past tense, so when that is, and certainly by name it matters. It's also odd because the only time he does it is in the next word.
Yeah.
I have called by name, Bezalel. So
it's a redundancy.
Exactly. Right. So those of you who have studied a little rabbis before will know that anytime it seems like there's a redundancy, the rabbis have a field day, and they do. We'll have some understanding of what that's about also. The Midrash that we won't read together because it's almost silly draws an analogy. There's a point in the book of Esther when King Ahasuerus calls a concubine by name. It's the same phrase. And the point there is that the concubine has some higher status amongst concubines. So it's like a ridiculous, like, can't think of a more different case to prove the same point. But formally, that's where it's used to draw a similar case. But still, absolutely, it's odd. It's definitely formal. Like, this has the feel of, like, declaration, trumpets, look, behold, here is the case. So this is some sort of formal announcement of Bezalel's status. Here, let me get you a... You just pass a packet back to Norm. Thanks. Okay, let's keep going. You're doing a great job reading. Go for it.
And I have filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom and in understanding and in knowledge and in all manner of workmanship, to devise skillful works, to work in gold and in silver and in brass, and in cutting of stones for setting, and in carving wood, to work in all manner of workmanship.
Okay, so pause there. So tell me about Bezalel. What did we just learn about him? Yes, please.
His talents are God-given.
His talents are God-given. Okay, that's definitely probably the easiest way to read it. I'm not 100% sure that's what it means, but okay. Yes?
Well, do you make anything of the fact that God says, I have filled him with the Spirit of God, as opposed to I have filled him with my spirit, or...
So
he's using the third person there.
Excellent. So in Hebrew, we actually talked about this a little bit last time when we talked about the Urim and the Tumim. The Hebrew is Ruach Elohim, which Spirit of God is a good translation, but it's at least conceivable to consider that a technical term. It doesn't mean generally he now has the connection to God, but Ruach Elohim is actually a level of connection to God, a technical level below prophecy, but above just about everything else. So I have somehow made this person closer to me, more aware of what I want in the world. But it's not generally Ruach Elohim also. It's Ruach Elohim about what? Let's be specific here. What does it say?
Knowledge.
Wisdom.
Skill.
So for sure, we've got the skilled craftsmanship. Gold, silver, brass, stone cutting, wood cutting. First of all, usually it's a different person to do each of those things. So that in and of itself is amazing. Second of all, those are clearly like hand art kinds of things. And we have three words actually, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, which each of them you can debate how to translate, but they're synonyms. You can, you know, argue different meanings and people do, but three different things. So somehow he's got three different kinds of knowledge. And he uses those to employ and be able to do all of these different kinds of crafts. Yes?
Something very profound missing here. Doesn't call him or refer to him as a tzaddik.
It's true. We don't know if he could have been a jerk. We have no idea about his personal quality. The rabbis, of course, don't go that way. But it's an excellent point. So far, we only know, and we all know artists who are like that. Like, if you know anyone in the creative field, you can very easily find someone who is the most amazing artist ever and who isn't a nice person.
But this one was a nice person. He says the God had filled him with chokmah, wisdom. Tvuna is another word for chokmah, the God, so he was a good man.
So unless you read first of all, having knowledge and wisdom doesn't mean you use it. But let's assume that you do.
But we
have our case in front of us, so it's still a nice thing. It doesn't say specifically that he does anything nice to anyone else ever, so we don't know for sure. And also, you could also read that all three of these, Da'at, Tvuna, and Chokmah, are only in relation to what comes right after, the ability for skilled craftsmanship. That they're connected, as opposed to being separate. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying another legitimate read is to say...
And in every craftsman, or I don't know what is the noun for that?
Yeah.
So the Chokmah, Tvunah, Uvedat is really kind of separate, and then and in.
So I agree that you can read it that way. I'm only saying that because they're all in a list in the same way, it is at least conceivable to mean that they're all building upon the same idea, building up to this craftsmanship thing. But you're 100%, it does not explicitly tell us, at least, that he was a good person. We would like to believe that he is, and that he is a kind person and all those things, but we don't have it explicitly in text. I hadn't thought of it before. All right, I want to do one more verse. You're doing great.
And I,
good.
Behold, I have appointed with him Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach of the tribe of Dan. And in the hearts of all that are wise hearted, I have put wisdom, that they may make all that I have commanded thee.
So pause there. So I have I mentioned Aholiab particularly because in rabbinical school, I spent time, I said, who's your favorite character to my like favorite text in all of Judaism? And a friend of mine chose this verse, that Aholiab is her favorite because he gets like no credit anywhere. He's the guy who shows up. He's not even the number one. He's the number two. He does what he needs to do. And he's equally as good, but like nowhere does I looked and basically all of rabbinic literature is mentioned once, and if we have a chance we'll look at it, and it's only in his relation to Bezalel, and for that, you know, good for Aholiab. Yes.
I'd like to bring your attention to
please
Belev Kol Chacham, and in the heart of every wise man, or Lev Chacham, Kol Chacham, a good man,
wise
God
person
has added goodness.
Wise,
so that
wisdom.
That would also reflect on Bezalel. He was already a Chacham, and God has given him.
So I 100% agree with you, except that Chokhmah is wisdom. It's not Tzdikut, I guess. And that's not righteousness. It's not. In fact, specifically, we have another word for that. So I agree with you. And you point out something that we'll spend some time, if we have a chance, looking at, that in the second half, it says, I will give wisdom to those that have wisdom. Mm-hmm. You know, like, there's something, you have to start with something. What exactly does that mean? Is God adding, or is God saying that I'm going to focus their wisdom? I don't know what that means, but we'll look at it in a little bit. Yes?
Are you going to comment today on what the meaning of their names are?
Excellent. So do you know? Bezalel is in the shadow of God. So a lot of, I mean, first of all, he's the only Bezalel in the Bible, so that in of itself is exciting. But there's a lot of talk about what exactly that means. And Aholiab, there's not much talk, but it probably means something like in the tent of our father, or God, my father is the tent, something, tent, father, God. Mm-hmm. Choose your order of words. And he's from the tribe of Dan. So those are all of the relevant things, I think, so far, unless someone has something else. And we also find out that there is, you know, everyone else also. So I'm giving a Bezalel, Aholiab, and you'll have, you know, I don't know, some sort of very intelligent day laborers as well, who are part of the team. So let's go to, we're going to change to the part where now Moses is actually taking the word of God. So I have called Bezalel, he's going to be your guy. Now Moses goes to talk to Bezalel a couple of chapters later. And let's see if, or the people in general about Bezalel, sorry. Let's see if there's anything different. There is. Not a lot, but a little bit. Does someone else want to read this time? Please.
And Moses said unto the children of Israel, see, the Lord hath called by name Bezalel. The son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. And he hath filled him with the Spirit of God, in wisdom, in understanding, and in knowledge, and in all manner of workmanship, and to devise skillful works, to work in gold and silver and in brass, and in cutting of stones for setting, and in carving of wood, to work in all manner of skillful workmanship.
Okay, so far it's an exact quote, not a word off. Keep going.
And he hath put in his heart that he may teach both he and Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan.
Okay, so pause there. There's one major change, and I'm honestly not sure what to do with it. None of the rabbis mention it that I saw. So what's the change?
Moses said.
Okay, so yes. Sorry, two major changes. Yeah. We have now taken it from God saying it to Moses saying it. Moses says it to B'nai Yisrael. Let's see if we can be really... And now I'm worried that I missed it if you're not seeing it. No, it's definitely there. Yes, teach. Where did this come from? God says nothing to Moses that Bezalel and Aholiab are teachers. Your job is to go do it. But here suddenly we have teachers. So what... that their job is to teach it. It says, "Ulehorot natam belibo." You'll have to teach to all those that I have given with heart or whoever it is.
34.
Lehorot. So what do you think it is? Why does Moses add in to teach? Yes. Beautiful. Yes?
Well, what I'm flashing on here is to go back to Moses' father-in-law, who came in and said, look, you can't do the whole thing. You've got to have judges for the people.
Yeah,
and here he's now saying Bezalel and Aholiab are not going to do it all themselves. They're going to teach you guys how to do it.
And that's beautiful, because where does Moses learn that from? He learns it from a non-Jew, from outside the religion. So Moses is the one who adds it in to God's teaching. That's a nice drash. I like that a lot. Yeah.
And the people may say, well, how are we supposed to do this? We don't know how to do any of this. And so he's
great.
Assuring them that Aholiab and Bezalel will teach them how to do it, that they will have the same wisdom.
Great. So another thing is, God is God and Moses is Moses. So God can say something and people will just be, okay, that's the way it will be. Moses is a flesh and blood person who's getting up and saying this is what it will be. If he's going to be able to get buy-in from everyone, he needs to add a little more. Don't worry if you're worried, because they'll teach you this is God selected. Great. Another one. Yes?
Well, on Pasuk 34.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, not everybody does whatever they want. He's the leader. He's the one that tells.
So it's also like Menahel, like you're the boss.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Great. I think that's probably fair also, that Moses would be more concerned than God with hierarchy of how it's actually, like, that's the difference. Moses is actually going to make it happen, and then even more so Bezalel. Yes.
I wonder if I could slip back just for a second.
Always.
Starting with number 5.
As long as we don't go to Clark Gable. Yes.
And the word manna troubled me for a minute.
Yeah.
It slipped my mind. Then I turned the page, and all manner of workmanship is repeated 3 more times, and the word skillful is added in. So we have a phrase that's used 4 times.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the way we think of the Torah, it's got to have some special meaning. And nothing else, I think, is mentioned 4 times in this very short thing, except a couple of names.
Yeah.
The word skillful is added in. And then the phrase that really got me was, all manner. You can't, once you teach the skill, the technique, you can't stop an artist from creating. And I suspect that some of these people may have created what we would now call graven images. They would have carved pictures of people and what they thought of as people. Not just garments, not just vestments and things of that kind. I think it's very, once the creative juice is unleashed,
yeah,
once the technique is
learned, then stuff
good
comes.
Guy, the bad guy, he's going to do whatever.
Interesting. I like that. It's, yeah. All right. Beautiful. All right. So we're going to spend a minute on Aholiab, the one text where he's mentioned, because a little respect for Aholiab, and then we'll move on. So turn to page 4.
Can I ask you something on page 3?
Always. Yes, please.
It just tells how who is the father.
Yeah. Yeah.
He is, I guess, the grandfather, whatever.
Yeah.
Who had given birth to Azuba, Isha, right?
Yeah.
So that means Azuba is his daughter. And then later on it goes, and when Azuba died, Caleb, who is her father, took Ephrat and for a woman as a wife, and he had Hur. Usually, I mean, what does Azuba has to do with the fact that she died with what's his name? Usually you leave that, and Azuba died if she was the wife of Caleb, but she was not the wife of Caleb, she was just his daughter. Do I read it wrong?
So I think the translation is actually trying to deal with what you're talking about. When it says Holid et Azuba Isha, I think
birth,
right.
Azuba, so that she's his daughter.
So, no, that's not. I'm translating it differently.
Oh.
So I think what the translation here is trying to say is that Azuba Isha is an aside. Azuba is Caleb's wife.
Oh.
And we're saying gave birth to Holid et. And it's an odd, I think that's the problem here, is Isha should mean wife. And so it says it can't give birth. First of all, he can't give birth to anyone. But to be clear. But it's an unclear, because if it says Isha, that's referring to wife, but it says Holid et. So the translation is trying to say what it must have meant is that Azuba was the wife and that together they gave birth to Yeriot. You can disagree with that, but I think that's what the trying to make sense of it. Okay, page 4 at the bottom. Someone fill up to reading? I got big letters today. I can't always make it big, but this time I got it relatively large. Yeah. Okay, that's the whole thing. This is what we learn about Oholiab. What was his job? So Dan had the worst reputation. They were the weakest. I think if you follow, I did not look into this, but if I remember correctly, Dan gets conquered left and right throughout the book of Judges and before the people of Israel are established. So what they mean is greatest in sort of political and military might. And Judah, obviously the Lion of Judah is the strongest. It has one of the largest territories and it's the one that lasts. It's us. And so got the drash here in Exodus Rabbah, which is a compilation of Midrash, is, and that is why from the very outset of these tribes, Oholiab and Bezalel are paired together to remind Judah not to be so proud of themselves and to remind Dan not to be so down on themselves. So we take their skill is even, it's even a little smarter because their skill is not in anything but working with your hands. It's a practical skill, and they both are able to lead the thing together. It's a nice drash also because that's how we are as people. It's easy for us to feel either of those, and if we can hold on to both a little Dan and a little Judah, that's where we wind up finding our happiest self. Okay, we love Oholiab, nice guy. Moving on. I want to jump ahead to page 8. Samson Raphael Hirsch is the sort of granddaddy of modern Orthodox Judaism. So he is in the early 1800s after the Enlightenment. So the Enlightenment comes, and for the Jews, what that means is that secular nation states exist in the world, and they say to Jews, why don't you become part of us? Napoleon literally convened his own Sanhedrin of Jews who wanted them to say, stop being Jews and start being French people. And of course, something in between happened, but that's the crisis of modernity for Judaism. What we're still trying to figure out today. And Hirsch is the one who said everyone should go to university, everyone should be a part of the secular world, but don't change an ounce of halakha. Everyone should put their tefillin on every day, sit separate from women in the synagogue, and, you know, all the rest of it. That was his answer. That was the message of modern orthodoxy. None of that's relevant to this. I just, you know, to know who we're reading. He also did an excellent commentary on the whole Torah. So let's read his first paragraph. The intro, it's a little, it's not a great copy, so I'll read this one. With the preceding verse, the instructions for the establishment of the sanctuary are completed. Okay, Moses, here's everything you need to build the Mishkan, the traveling sanctuary. All that was now needed was the appointment of the craftsmen to carry them out, and the presentation of an object, the evidence of the Torah, the tablets of the law, which was to be given by God, God's self, and not to be made by the hand of man. It was not to make a home. It was to make a home for this object that the whole sanctuary was to be erected by human hands. Both the appointment and the presentation now follow in the chapter. So it's a good setup, a good intro for what we're talking about now, a good feel of everything. The Mishkan is about combining the work of man with the work of God, just like Bezalel is that kind of image for us. His name means in the shadow of God. What does he do? He's endowed with Ruach Elohim, with the Spirit of God to do what he's doing. And he's building a house for the stone tablets, which were created by God, which in and of themselves are a symbol for the greater covenant, which in and of itself is a symbol for our general relationship with God. It's a layered kind of thing. But that's our setup. Are there any questions about that? Comments, ideas? You don't have to. Great. Okay. Now I want to spend some time with these three ideas of wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. I want to begin. One guy breaks it down good, and I made notes, so I know which one it is. Ah, excellent. Page 9. This was a fascinating. First of all, if any of you have not spent good time in our library, we are blessed to have an excellent library here at Sinai, and I strongly encourage it. One of the books I found, which is one I did not know, called All the Men of the Bible. I'm told he also wrote All the Women of the Bible and one or two others in the series. This is what he has to say about Bezalel.
Is this still Hirsch?
No. Now this is a guy, I don't know who he is, Herbert Lockyer. I've never heard of him before. I just stumbled across the book in the Bible in the library as I was looking for things on Bezalel. So he has three reasons. Oh, so I apologize. He doesn't talk about the three. He does, but in one thing. But he has three reasons why Bezalel makes the cut. Why is he the reason, that the guy who's going to be the leader? And he talks a little to your point, actually, about the whether or not he's a good guy. This I think it's pretty big. Someone fill up to reading? Someone else? Okay, I'll go for it. Oh, go for it.
Bezalel was chiefly responsible for works of metal, wood, and stone. Aholiab had charge of the textile fabric. Bezalel, however, was chief in both departments and was the principal workman for the accomplishment of a divinely commissioned task. He received divine empowerment. Whom the Lord calls, he qualifies. His character, Bezalel, meaning in the shadow of God, is suggestive of this artificer's, is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Character. Although he doubtless received the name from godly parents who knew that it was to dwell beneath the shadow of the Almighty, Bezalel himself must have lived a life in the will of God and was therefore responsive when the call came.
So interesting. So two things. One, his name gives us two things. First, he's got good parentage. If his parents were willing to give him a name like that, that meant that they were also trying to live in the shadow of God. And two is that Bezalel answered the call. At no point does he say, I answered the call, but he does it. So we get the idea that he does. And that in and of itself is a testament, perhaps, to his character. Although I can't imagine being an artist and God says, come build me my house, and you say, actually, I'm busy right now. That seems like the kind of phone call you take. But nonetheless, so at least we have that pointing to towards some sort of character of trying to walk in the ways of God. Great. Keep going.
Two, his commission. Bezalel alone had the right to devise. He was the principal workman in the erection of the tabernacle, the pattern of which came direct from God. The choice of Bezalel proves that the Holy Spirit is sovereign in his work. We cannot understand why he chooses certain people for great tasks. As the wind, he blows where he listeth. His gifts are distributed severely as he wills.
Okay, so the choice of Bezalel also seems to be an implication of taking humanity out of the Mishkan. The Mishkan, at least according to this understanding, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, is made by the hands of man, but is as close to God made as it can be. That Bezalel's job is actually as a shadow of God to work into trying to produce the image of another. It's the same thing that oftentimes artists don't actually produce their own art, especially like sculptors and metal workers and big things. They have like a team of people who do the actual work, and they say, join this there and mold that there. That's the image that at least this guy's understanding of Bezalel. Keep going. You're doing great.
Third, his cunning. This English word used in the Bible simply represents skill, ability. Thus, Bezalel was filled with all wisdom and understanding in all manner of workmanship.
There's your phrase.
All he needed to accomplish the mind and will of God was divinely bestowed. God's commands are his enablings. Give what thou commandest, prayed Augustine. Then command that thou wilt. So the great overseer, the Holy Spirit, possessed Bezalel, inspired him to prepare the temporary habitation of God. In our time, the same empowering Spirit gives to every man his work, and only that which is accomplished under the guidance of the Spirit can be pleasing to God and fit for a place in his great temple.
So he's obviously getting a little preachy here, but still, he's saying Bezalel then becomes a model for all of us, that we have in ourselves innate gifts, and we have only to try and understand what God wants of us, that we can then enable those gifts to sort of to make more of God's presence in the world. Are you guys okay in the sun? Like, a couple of you are, like, right in the sunlight. You know, okay? Yeah?
It's interesting that he uses the word cunning, because they say it's really represents skill, ability, but we don't think of cunning as being skill and ability. You know, we think of it almost as being sneaky, or it has a different connotation.
So I think here, and now I'm really just guessing. So this is, I mean, I don't know if you caught this, but this is obviously a Christian writer. Which is, you know, they have the Old Testament too, or the First Testament, so great. I suspect that one of the areas that that Christianity is uncomfortable with in our Bible, one way to read the Bible is sneakiness over might. Constantly, we win by being sneaky. We as a people, our ancestors, Jacob, you know, tricks Esau, that's the value. Sneakiness, cunning is here. And so I wonder if this is a way to try and reappropriate that cunning as good with your hands.
What is the word in Hebrew?
So it's a good question. He doesn't say which one he means, but I think that he's talking about, it's either Chochmah, Tuna, or Dat. I'm not sure, to be perfectly honest. Right. So
it should have been his skill.
Yeah.
Is what, but not, because he said it represents skill or ability. So that to me would be why.
And we have skill. It's capable. A good point, actually. I didn't catch that the first time I read it. Fair enough.
Even if it wasn't skill, they would say it's wisdom.
Oh, it's machshavot. I'm almost positive. Yeah, because machshavot also has in it choshev, like to think, thoughts. So you could argue that that's cunning also, like careful thoughts or something like that.
Yeah.
And here it's also the skill is a fair enough translation of that also.
That in English it means that, but or in the Bible.
It's a good point. It is always dangerous. A professor of mine, who's now the head of Bible at JTS, liked to tell a story that he, where across the street from the Jewish Theological Seminary is the Union Theological Seminary, which is a Christian seminary. And he teaches a Bible class there from time to time. And he had a student, and he was explaining on the way Hebrew grammar changed the meaning depending on how you read, you know, the sentence and the words. And afterwards, a guy came up to him and said, "You know, Rabbi, that's real nice, but I prefer to read the Bible in the original King James." So as you play from one religion to the next, especially with language, what becomes the original text can also play around. I'm not saying that I don't know anything about this guy or what exactly he meant, but yes, that much I read is clear. Okay, let's try and jump back to the Talmud, actually on page 4. Let's look into this wisdom a little more. What is Bezalel's wisdom? What is the kind of wisdom the rabbis understood him to have? Does someone feel up for reading Rabbi Samuel Bar Nachmat? Okay, I'll read. So Rabbi Samuel Bar Nachman, he said in the name of Rabbi Jonathan, Bezalel was so called on account of his wisdom. Okay, was so called, that's the same language, you know, that God called Bezalel. When the Holy One said to Moses, "Go and tell Bezalel to make me the tabernacle, ark, and vessels," Moses went and reversed the order. Moses forgot what he said and said, "Make an ark, vessels, and the tabernacle." Bezalel countered, "Moses, our teacher, as a rule, a man first builds a house and then brings his vessels into it.
Oh, sure.
But you say, make me an ark, vessels, and tabernacle. The vessels I make, where am I to put them? Perhaps the Holy One said to you, make the tabernacle, ark, and vessels." Moses replied, "You may well have been in the shadow of God, and so you know." Oh. And that's actually what happens. The instructions are in reverse order for how it gets completed. So this is asking a question we didn't even get to ask, which is to say, there's some seats in the front row if you want, Norm, that aren't in the sun yet. I feel bad. Like sun's right in your eyes. There you go. Don't worry about it. Which is to say, why does this happen? Why do we get the instructions in the reverse order of how they happen? And so we get the answer here that we need the guy who actually builds stuff to be like, Moses, maybe we shouldn't do it that way. Great teacher. Moses is like, yeah, you must have been there too. You must have been up in the mountain too. So one wisdom is still focusing on that. Bezalel's the guy who knows how to make it happen, who knows how to take the nothing and turn it into the something, the idea and turn it into an actual thing. Yeah, one and then two.
Bezalel, I think the first paragraph is very interesting, and I think it explains exactly what you said. He says it's no accident that Bezalel and King Solomon, the great builders, are...
Oh, I was going to end with that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, fair enough. Yes, go ahead. We might as well. Read on.
What it does is that it puts it all together. Great builders are a tradition of the two who are considered the most wise. Throughout the last few parshiot, Bezalel is characterized as wise-hearted. He represents the seamless merger between the cognitive and the intuitive, between the contemplative and the pragmatic. Everything he creates is as if he were standing in the shadow of the eternal. And just what you were saying,
yes.
Bezalel is pragmatic. He knows, you know, being the experienced one of actually doing this, you know, how it should be done.
Yes. Excellent. And so, and wise is, the word chokhmah is used both for King Solomon and for Bezalel, and they both were builders. They both, in fact, built the temple.
Yeah.
The Mishkan, and then eventually the first temple. And there's this image of the shadow of the eternal. And what is a shadow? A shadow is kind of caught between two worlds. A shadow is like in the world, but it's not exactly the thing it is of. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's really what these things are trying to accomplish. They're trying to be like God, but still in the world. And so that's where the image comes in. Yeah.
jumping ahead now.
Please.
Is Bezalel one of those that gets to go into the Promised Land?
Okay. So that is one of the reasons we say that. So yes is the thought, because he's Caleb's great-grandson, yep. That the idea is Caleb and his whole family gets to go in, even though they were in the land of Egypt. Yes.
How are we doing our time? Good. On television,
I like where this is headed. Yes. So
it was a Hancock, and
it
was a big, big book 20 years ago. I forget the title. The whole research on that. It's in Ethiopia. Yes. That's what last week we talked about. The thing is, they live in Israel, and they know. And they send someone to come and take it. They can't. Because there is one priest. He keeps that place. When he dies,
so I definitely have heard that there is a thing that people say is the tabernacle, and that there is all of this about it. Other than that, I don't know. Anytime anything seems that exciting, I get a little suspicious, because I always wonder exactly what that is or going on. But if the Ethiopians are, like we say, they're the lost tribe who left around this time, there's no reason to think. It is not unreasonable to think that that could be some either version of or an original tabernacle or something along those lines, or they rebuilt something a long time ago that was similar, because now they had moved and they needed their own tabernacle, or any of those in-betweens. Yes?
Like the history, it says Queen Sheba, when she had a baby from
The Ark of the Covenant?
The Ark of the Covenant, and then they came and they lived.
Great.
The book is called Signs and Seals.
They live in his life together?
Oh, yeah.
So.
Just read the book of Signs.
Okay, so we're gonna move past it for now. We have a couple minutes before we wrap up. The next piece I want to do is from Ibn Ezra, which I'll also read because it gets a little. The copies of the one. So Ibn Ezra comments on these three words, skill, ability, and knowledge.
We're on page six.
Ibn Ezra is a medieval commentator. He's known for being weird in a couple of ways, or unique if you want. First is, he wrote really one of the first grammars of the Hebrew Bible. He was the closest thing to an academic before academia existed in the way we understood it. Conservative Jews like to claim him as the first conservative Jew, because he's one of the first to really examine some of the fault lines of the text that we do in sort of modern scholarship. Excuse me. And on top of all of it, he's also unique in that he's one of the very few commentators who doesn't comment on the Talmud and only comments on the Bible. That was very weird for scholars, especially in the Middle Ages, to do.
What century exactly?
I don't know. I don't remember off the top of my head. I want to say like 11th, 12th, but I don't remember off the top of my head. I apologize.
I just wanted to know if it was before Maimonides or
after. After Maimonides. All right, skill, ability, and knowledge. He had great skill and knew all sorts of hidden mysteries. For only one who was extremely skillful was capable of constructing the Holy of Holies. And Bezalel understood mathematics, biology, physics, and metaphysics far beyond anyone else of his generation. So I'll pause there. The other thing important to know is that he lives in the Middle Ages, but in the Arab world. In the Arab world, it was really almost how we have the Greek world. In the Arab world in the Middle Ages, the entire Greek everything was revitalized and translated into Arabic, and Jewish scholars would have studied like Aristotle and Pythagoras in Arabic. He so understood the mystery of the tabernacle that he understood the mystery of its thickness. This too teaches us that he was not a boy, for when could a boy have learned all this knowledge? So pause there for a second. There's a midrash that says not only all of this, but Bezalel was 12 when all this happened, or 13, whatever. It's later on in the packet. It's a midrash, and Ibn Ezra, the scholar that he is basically like, you're crazy. That's just silliness. Depending on how mystical you want to make him, it makes even more sense. Like, if you really want to make it that it's not about him, but he is the one transmuting God's presence into the world, then 12-year-old is perfect because he's just his blank canvas is the idea. Although, if you've ever met a 12-year-old, it's not exactly how they function. or if you're an Ibn Ezra and you're much more of a pragmatist and a realist, you understand that no, he was just the best craftsman of his time. So we'll keep going. And so first there's a bit about Solomon, but we don't know how long he lived. Okay, so this is where I went. In my commentary, skipping down a little bit, my commentary to Proverbs, I have explained the difference between wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. Chokhmah, or as the Arab philosophers describe it, calculation, resides in the back part of the brain. Tvunah, introspection, in the middle of the brain. And Daat, imagination, in the front of the brain, next to the sense receptors. In every kind of crap, there are those who have wisdom of every kind but cannot actually do any kind of work successfully. But Bezalel could do this. Had the skill and could wisdom and the skill. And then the one translation omits the "and" that makes this point clear, and the old translation says and in all manner of workmanship. But we'll leave that last part at the end. The reason why I put it here, put all three of these here, is just as a point of saying that people were literal then. These three things, they understood different parts of the brain, and that's where they functioned, and that's what he meant. It's also fascinating, like Daat, which is we translate it as knowledge, to imagine that as imagination, it's like the farthest thing from imagination. Chokhmah is closer to imagination. So just to think about how the concept of knowledge has changed over time is interesting to me. All right, I want to finish up with one text, which is something I was wondering if anyone was going to bring up on their own, but I want to think about Nachmanides, Ramban, who lives also in Spain under Arab rule before the expulsion, close to the expulsion, but not quite during the expulsion. He's famous. He was in a lot of trouble. The Christians used to organize these debates. Where they would come and say, let us, on the Talmud, we'll argue about why Judaism's wrong and Christianity's right. And Nachmanides famously got basically he said, I won't, basically, if Jews did a good job, they got killed after the debate. So Nachmanides is like, I'm not going to do this because I'll win. And he gets an indemnification from the king that says, we won't kill you. And he basically has to run away and like hide, and like eventually he's okay. But he famously won the debate, saying, no, the Talmud doesn't say that, you know, we should be Christians. It's not a hard argument to make now that we think about it, but that is what was happening at the time. So let's see what he has to say. He also is probably one of the grandfathers of mysticism as we understand it today. Page 7. Thank you for reminding me to tell you what page we're on. There's no point in giving you a text and then... Ramban. Yeah, Nachmanides. He also did not like Rambam at all, which is like, you know, at the, I mean, they never knew each other. They're different time-wise. But there were, Rambam's books at the times were often burned. Rambam was out. No, don't study Rambam. Which makes sense, because Rambam is the like ultimate academic scholar. He's a, he reads Aristotle and Plato, and Ramban is ultimately a mystic. So you can imagine the two don't get along. Yeah, give or take. Maybe even more than that. But yes, something like, yeah, about that. Ramban is in the 1300s, and Rambam is the turn of the millennia. So like 300 or 400 years, yeah. Okay, I have singled out by name Bezalel. In 3530, Moses will repeat this remark to the Israelites. In Egypt, the Israelites were so ground down by laboring with bricks and mortar that they learned nothing of how to work with gold, silver, and precious stones. They never even saw such things. It is a miracle that God found anyone among them who knew all the things Bezalel did. For even among those who have the opportunity to study, one does not find a man who is expert in all of the different crafts simultaneously. Even the most skillful of the Israelites, spending all day with his hands in clay and mud, will lose the ability to do delicate, beautiful work. But Bezalel not only was expert in all crafts, but had the wisdom to understand the mystery of the tabernacle and its furnishings and everything that they symbolize. That is why God told Moses, see. He wanted him to see what a miracle it was and to understand that it was God who had endowed him with the ability to make the tabernacle. For it had always been God's will to make their tabernacle in the wilderness. And he who announced the generations from the start created Bezalel in his own glory. Before I created you in the womb, I selected you. Exodus Rabbah has the following midrash. God showed Moses the book of Adam and told him, at the very first moment of creation, I prepared one person for every task. As the Torah says, I have singled out by name Bezalel. This is what I have explained. Our sages also said, Bezalel knew the combination of letters by which heaven and earth were created, for the tabernacle symbolized the universe, and it was Bezalel who knew and understood this mystery. Mm-hmm. All right, one and then two. Yes. Great. So I think that's, I think we have, either we have to argue that they somehow on the way out saw it or something like that, or I think Ramban is making a point with hyperbole. Like I, there's no reason to think they would have never seen that. They had Egyptians who were overseers who would have like had gold on them. There were idols everywhere. That was part of the problem. So I think ever seen it is just like a dramatically trying to show the point of just how downtrodden they were. Two and then three.
So, Bezalel, the earlier texts paint him as, we would imagine he was born after Egypt.
Right.
Therefore would not have had his hands in clay.
So.
And so there's that contradiction in this text also.
Yeah.
And the fact that they had jewelry and pretty things.
Right, so there's an unending list of midrashim of where. So they said, "Comes time to build the tabernacle," and suddenly the Israelites produce an extraordinary wealth of gold and rubies and gems and all these things. And where they come from, the solution that fits with what you're saying is that basically there's a half a verse during the plague of darkness, and or again later. Now I'm not exactly remembering, like right when they leave, where basically God says, go ask your friends for gold and stuff, your Egyptian neighbors, and I'll make them say yes. Or I'll make them pliable to your request. So that might be where all this comes from, or it seems at least a little bit likely that if you have an entire people, they amass some wealth in some way, shape, or form that exists in some way. And I would even argue that Ramban's probably not entirely right, because if you have a bunch of slaves and you're making a giant city and one of them is good with gold, you want them to make the gold thing that's going to be in your city. But aside, yes, one and then two.
Yeah, you just said what I wanted to say.
Ah.
They gave him gold and stuff. But it's one thing to look
That's nicer than what I said.
It's one thing to look at something, let's say a gold necklace, and appreciate it and make it. Make it is different. I mean,
yes. Well, absolutely. A good point also. Yes.
Isn't all this taking place within about a year after they left Egypt?
So Sinai is about 3 months after Egypt.
Yeah. So Bezalel must have been born in...
Yeah, so I think he would have had to have been born in Egypt, and Caleb would have had to be relatively old, I guess, and then last a long time. Yes?
In Girona, outside of Barcelona in the Jewish section, there's tremendous exhibits on several floors of the Ramban and the people were engineers, astronomers. It's a fascinating time for the Jewish people. But also here, where Eben Ezra comments about sections of the brain, now I guess the neurologists talk about right brain people.
Right.
Yeah.
To draw he or she, then they call them right brain person. But
I think draw is left brain and Lego would be right brain. I think they're different, actually.
Yeah.
But whatever. Whatever the thing is. The opposite?
Creative is the right side.
Really?
And it comes out of the left side.
Okay, great.
But it raises an interesting point with this law. Is it possible to do something before you think?
Is it possible to do something before you think? Why, say more.
So, I don't know. Maybe he had this divine endowment.
Right.
Uh-huh.
But when they talk about wisdom, like we're studying on Sunday, and they say that wisdom is fear of God, the first step of being wise.
Right.
And here there's no mention about his fearing God.
It's true.
It comes from good lineage, because Ur was his grandfather.
Yeah.
Right. The Amalekites, so he must have been
between that and Caleb, that's good people. So I think all of this is exactly where we're supposed to be, actually. I think we get very little from Bezalel. I liked ending with this idea of Bezalel as a miracle, that one of the things God is doing with the tabernacle is giving us something pretty on purpose. We're wandering through the desert, but not just giving us something pretty, but look, 3 months ago you were slaves. Now I've taken your best and you've made something beautiful that is not just yours, but is about your God. Not Egyptian gods, not some statue, it's yours. You have a special relationship with me and you made this beautiful thing because together, you and us, together can make beautiful things. And I think that's foundational for creating a people for the next step. Yes. Yeah.
Then the notion of choice.
Yeah.
And already written for you.
So we can spend another whole lifetime, but the Bible definitely clearly has two threads that are opposing. One of my teachers used to talk about the Bible being written as tension rather than as message. So a story has a message and you learn what it is. The Bible actually has conflicting messages all the time and exists in tension. And one of them is between free will and predestination, that throughout the entire Bible, you can easily cite a slew of evidence that prove either side, and because that's how we experience life, actually. That there are times when we really understand that we are fulfilling our destiny and this is where everything in our life has been leading towards, and other times when we, hang a Yui without, necessarily knowing what's going on and change our direction. The last piece I want to just point out is this little bit at the end about knowing the combinations of letters. This is foundational to mysticism, to Kabbalah, that Ramban is saying that what Bezalel had and could know was the secret understanding of Torah and of God, and was able to use that secret understanding to produce that. It's crucial to the development of mysticism that there be a layer behind everything, that knowledge of which allows you to uncover God's presence in the world. And with that, I wish you all a little secret knowledge and a little God's presence. We'll rise for Kaddish de Rabbanan.